Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center, marking 50 years of compassion and care. Learn more at ANHC's Open House, August 5th, or at anhc.org.
Welcome to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Tordat. Today, I have Don Reardon in the studio with me. Don is the author of The Raven's Gift and Without a Paddle, and co-author of The Warrior's Creed and Never Quit. He's a professor at University of Alaska Anchorage. Welcome to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Tordat. Today, I have Don Reardon in the studio with me. Don is the author of The Raven's Gift and Without a Paddle, and co-author of The Warrior's Creed and Never Quit. He's a professor at University of Alaska Anchorage. Welcome to the show, Don.
Oh, thanks for having me on, Paul. It's one of my favorite shows.
Oh, thanks. Hey, what a great body of work you have. I've really enjoyed The Raven's Gift and Without a Paddle. Tell us a bit about yourself. You had a fascinating story to tell, and sort of how that's led you to where you are now.
Well, thanks for that. It was funny when you asked me to be on, I was kind of like, wow, what, this is book stuff, and like, why Outdoor Explorer, I don't belong on there. And then I was thinking about the stuff I write, and I was like, I don't write about the inside.
You don't, yeah.
And I live outside all the time. I'm just an outside person, kind of. That's how I was raised. And so, yeah, so I'm happy to be here and talk about this. And if I trace back, like, my kind of growth as a human being, it was all outside. My parents are people who that's just the life they lived. We're from Montana originally. My dad was like a outfitter and a guide and hunting guide, and my mom grew up on a ranch with horses, and then we moved to Alaska when I was a little kid and just continued that. We moved to Southwest Alaska on the Kuskokwim River, and so I was thinking about today, my daughter just went to school and she's in second grade. That's when I moved to Akyak, the first village I lived in.
Yeah.
And that was really what kicked me off on this outdoor life in Alaska. And then my writing too, in second grade, I started to have visions of being a writer.
Oh,
by the time I moved here, I'd read most of the Lewis L'Amour collections, Robert Service. I was all into that sort of outside world and kind of the Wild West world. And then in the summer, so summer of second grade, I'm going into third grade, and I was back in Montana visiting, and one of my cousins was in trouble because he was reading a Stephen King book and he was in high school, and I stole it, and it was The Shining.
Wow.
And I read it and I was ruined as a kid. You know, like, from then on, I was like, that's what I want to do. I want to write and scare people. I grew up a little bit, but I still like scaring people with my writing. And it fit because of where we lived. You know, at the time in Akyak, there were some abandoned buildings across the river, and those were really haunting to me. We lived in villages lived in the schools, and those were haunted. Everyone knows that village schools are haunted, and some of them were where we lived. And I kind of thrived on that, and I love the culture. I love the stories from the culture, and just grew up wanting to do that. And so my life kind of has revolved around Alaskan history and culture and writing and trying to write for mostly fun, I guess, to entertain myself. And I think at times probably trying to save myself too in different ways, you know.
It must have been a little challenging being a kid, 2-year-old, sort of uprooted and thrown in an entirely different culture.
Yeah, initially it was. I got my butt kicked a little bit as a kid.
I bet.
And then that toughened me up some. But at the same time, it was really magical too. We moved for me, it was a magical age. And to be transported into a culture that's, you know, where you have monsters and ghosts are a part of the culture, and little people, and that the landscape is magical in so many different ways, it's still transformative to me. It still gives me goosebumps, and I love that part of Alaska.
Yeah.
And I love exploring what that means in different ways. And as I get older, I understand it on different levels too.
Yeah. And how, what do you mean by that?
I think I appreciate some of those things in on deeper levels. You know, I grew up with the stories of the Big Mouth Baby, and you have this essentially a child monster that's killing people. And so as a kid, that's terrifying because the monster's still out there, and that keeps you from being naughty at night running around. But then you grow up and you start to realize that those stories are significant in their meaning, and from what we're supposed to learn from them, and how to raise a kid and how to make it be a part of the community. And if it doesn't, that kid will destroy the community. And so it's understanding that those old stories are meant to help us be human and teach us how to be human. And so I guess, you know, like understanding them as a little kid, being like, ooh, that's scary, and loving that feeling of being afraid. And then growing up and understanding that those stories of fear are meant to inform and teach us how to be people, how to be real human beings.
Do you use those stories with your kids?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, I do. I definitely do. They know them. And I've made the mistake of like going to their schools and sharing the stories, and the kids loved them. But then having some parents be like, why did you tell them that story? Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I know. And when I was down working in Mexico and Baja back in the 80s, that all the kids were like, there were monsters under the in dark places, and it's because of scorpions. Like the parents were like, scorpions and tarantula, like they wouldn't probably hurt an adult, but they'd kill a kid. And so the kids were very, very good around dangerous things, not necessarily for the logical reasons, but that's probably the same idea.
Yeah. And it all functions as a metaphor too, right? There are monsters in dark places.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And those might be human monsters, but you avoid those dark places. Learn that.
The first book I read of you is The Raven's Gift. It was very well received and seems like a big success. How did that, and I think in the poem Without a Paddle, you talk about the empty houses across the river, and I assume those are all connected. And at some point you got this idea for Raven's Gift. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, I think it's really funny. I have to reverse engineer where I got this stuff from, you know. I write the story and then I'm like, oh, that's where that came from. You know, people would ask me initially with The Raven's Gift, like, what kind of research did you do? And I would downplay and just say, nothing. I just wrote it. I saw a story and wrote it. And I wasn't realizing my whole life was the research for it, you know, uh-huh. Minus some of the science stuff that's underpinning the story of a pandemic hitting. But it's really, those houses that I mentioned at the beginning across the river, like, they were abandoned. Why were they abandoned? Why were there ghosts there? You know, and so, deeply rooted in growing up, hearing these stories of from survivors who had already survived those epidemics that hit. And that's like the underpinning for some of the horror that I think is in The Raven's Gift for sure, but also was me back in 2008 when I wrote that, wondering, like, what if this bird flu thing actually hits, and what would Alaska do, and are we prepared? And no, we're not. And
as we found out, yeah.
But I also, you know, having wrote the book, and then we survive a pandemic. But when it's hitting, I'm as worried as everyone else is, especially for rural Alaska. What I didn't recognize, which I should have, because I should have known that the knowledge is deep seated and rooted, and people were there and they were prepared. They knew what to do. They handled it better than the rest of us in many cases.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. So the Raven's Gift for me has been a continual learning experience. I'm still learning from it years after it's been published. Yeah.
Talk about it a bit, and maybe tell people who haven't read it a bit about it.
So we already lived it. I'm just kidding.
Unfortunately, not quite as bad as the book.
Things went a little worse, but then I planned, and then a little better, for sure. A little better, I guess. We didn't necessarily see the end, but it's a couple kind of naive outsiders coming to Alaska to go out to rural Alaska and teach and do good, and they're well intentioned, and then things kind of go sideways. A pandemic hits, and they're left trying to make sense of it and survive in a culture that already knows how to survive, but at the same time is struggling with the effects of colonialism and loss of culture. And it's a survival story, and it's a love story, and there's some scary stuff in it, but ultimately it was me dealing with, I think, a lot of what I grew up with, a lot of loss and trauma, and me trying to make sense of why some of my friends are gone, or incarcerated, or lost, you know, like still here, but are essentially, you know, struggling with those aftermath, the effects of alcoholism and drug abuse and stuff, and then some anger, kind of deep seated anger of the situation in rural Alaska, like why do we still have honey buckets? You know,
yeah.
Where's the sanitation issues and these third world diseases in a place like with so much potential? And so it was me making sense of that, this novel was, and I'm still trying to make sense of it. It was helping me deal with it. And it's essentially, I think, a hopeful story with the idea of what should be at the center of all of our lives are the youth and our elders.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the future should be, instead of just constantly thinking about extraction and jobs and thinking about people and the gold that's here already.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, and in the book, for those who haven't read, there's an elder and a youth and then a white, some, like you said, a couple of white people that are struggling with this. I'm sure you've heard this, reminiscent of McCarthy's The Road.
Minus
the Pulitzer. Well, you did get an award. You got, was it the Washington Post Notable List?
Yeah.
So that's pretty impressive. Yeah.
It's been, you know, of all the things, the most amazing thing is to know that it's taught in some schools and classes.
Yeah, oh, cool. That's really cool.
So yeah. Cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that Alaskans, you know, didn't hate me for writing it is also great.
Okay. How did you, was it easy, or how did you negotiate, you know, being a white guy, you know, writing about this culture that you obviously grew and lived with, but on the other hand, you're still not.
Oh, yeah.
I was
afraid that people would be angry at home. I was afraid I wouldn't be able to go home,
uh-huh.
You know, because there are horrible things in here. But I was trying to make a point, and I had friends read it and you know, who are Yupik, give me advice or make sure I got things correct. I mean, it's taught out at home in class.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so it's been okay. I can still go home.
You can still go.
Yeah. I'm still going back. And home, by home, I mean, is the Kuskokwim region, several villages, including Bethel.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, that's where I graduated from high school, and I taught high school there too for a while.
Yeah.
Before I moved on to UAA.
So you grew up out there, and then what, like school, like college? How'd that transition go?
It went pretty well. Yeah. I finished high school there, graduated in Bethel, and then I went to Fairbanks.
Okay.
Did my undergraduate there with kind of an English major and history minor and Yupik language thrown in, and then returned to Bethel. I taught there for a while, coached basketball and Native Youth Olympics, and then ultimately I wasn't writing, and because I was just so, you know, like teaching was all consuming, teaching and coaching, and I needed to write because that's what I was always going to do. And so then I was like, well, if I go back to college, go back and get my master's, I'd have some writing time. And that's, I took advantage of that, came to UAA, got my master's of fine arts in the program that doesn't exist anymore, sadly.
It's very sad.
I'm glad they have a new one at APU so people can do what I did. Got my MFA and then started teaching at the university and teaching and writing. So yeah, it worked out pretty well.
Yeah. This is Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Tordak. I'm talking with Don Reardon about his multiple books, The Raven's Gift and Without a Paddle, on Alaska Public Media. So, Don, your other books, so we're going to focus on Without a Paddle. It's the recent one. But you've also have a couple of the books that you've co-authored. Do you want to talk about those?
Yeah, sure. So my first co-authoring experience was with an Anchorage-born and raised kid. I guess he's not a kid anymore, Jimmy Settle. He was a good friend of mine, and he worked at Skinny Raven, and he was dating a good friend from Bethel at the time, and got to know him, and he had all these crazy stories, and he just would, like, these stories would dribble out once in a while, and then he'd been a runner and he'd went to the Naval Academy and he'd had a heart attack and all this weird stuff. And then all of a sudden he's training to become a PJ, who are pararescue people here, with the Air National Guard. And all of a sudden his story like transformed. And we had always joked that we had this comedy called Shoe Guy. It was going to be about Jimmy just selling shoes. And then he becomes this PJ, and I was like, whoa, your story is transformed. And then he went to Afghanistan, and I was watching TV one night with my wife, and there he was on national news with Lester Holt, and he'd gotten shot. He had survived, but his head was bandaged, and in Jimmy style, he's laying under the helicopter pointing to the hole in the helo. And he signed it, and clearly I'm putting things together. I'm like, my buddy's on national news with Lester Holt, and he's gotten shot in the head because his head's bandaged. And I'm like, wow, his story has transformed. And so ultimately I helped him tell his story in a book called Never Quit. And that was the pararescue men here, just, they're incredible human beings, and they're the guys that rescue us outdoor explorer people when we get in trouble.
Yeah.
They're some exceptional people. And through that process of writing that book with Jimmy, I met one of his colleagues who was kind of his mentor and somebody that was also in Afghanistan in the battle that Jimmy got injured in. And that was Roger Sparks. And that led to the next book, which was Warrior's Creed. And so I helped Roger write that book.
Yeah, and I think we're going to try to do a whole show on that book. That's an incredible story. We'll try to get Roger in here and talk about that.
I love that guy. He's a character. He's got lots of stories to tell.
Yeah, and that he ended up with a Silver Star, right, for his exploits in that rescue in Afghanistan, which is an incredible story, along with a lot of other stuff. So, and that book is recently out, Warrior's Creed?
Yeah, a few years ago. It's both of those books are have been well received. Yeah, people enjoy those. They're fun reads.
Yeah, and do you think your besides knowing these guys, we'll also talk about an avalanche story. You helped coach someone through. Is that connection? Why that connection with the outdoors? Besides your growing up, you still have it. Some people run away from that stuff.
Yeah.
You have enough trauma, you're like, oh, I'm done. You seem to be attracted to it still.
I think for me, it's when people have a story that needs to be told. Mm-hmm. And some of it could kind of also be where I see injustice. And like with Jimmy's case, he had a story that needed to be told, and I wanted to help him tell it. And then with Roger, the story was just so incredible. And there are definitely people who are going to tell it and wanted to tell it, and I think would have taken advantage of it, and it wouldn't have been his story.
Yeah.
And I wanted it to be, you know, I think it needs to be in their voice, and they need to tell the story because they're good storytellers. And so I think that's kind of what led me to that. And also, man, I guess a good story is hard for me to pass up. I have a weird affinity for, you know, powerful stories, but then I like to live them too, if that makes sense. And so when you dive in deep enough to a story, I start to dream it and see it and feel it.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's kind of how I try to write too. It's got to be visceral.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have to believe it and be there.
Well, your writing is very, just that, it's descriptive. When I read it, I can really imagine what's going on. And, especially like in Raven's Gift, and I can really, even though it's this apocalyptic vision of things a little bit, for some reason I can really relate to feel what you're doing and what you're thinking.
Thank you.
Yeah, yeah.
I think I cheat though too, because, well, for Alaskans, they've already seen it, and then I'm just kind of poking your brain with the little needle that makes you experience it. But when I write, I go to those places. And so I'm there, and I'm just recording what I'm seeing and feeling and hearing. And that sounds kind of strange, but I put myself in those places. And part of that for me probably is like, you know, when I left rural Alaska and moved to Anchorage, I needed to still be home and needed to be there, and I can write and transport myself there.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And if I don't want to be stuck inside on a nice day, so I'll transport myself outside.
Like right now, it's a nice day out today.
It is.
One of our nice days of the summer. I think that I don't know if all Alaskans actually can, you know, relate to that. I think, you know, for an average person in Anchorage or maybe even Fairbanks or urban Alaska, I think it is sort of hard to imagine the bush, and your writing helps with that, I think.
Well, thanks. That's true. That's really true. You know, there are, and there's plenty of people even in rural Alaska that I had plenty of my friends growing up in Bethel. I would just call them city kids.
Uh-huh.
You know, I could have taken them out on the tundra and spun them around, and they might have died right there.
Because
they just hadn't been outside. You know, they're in the gym playing basketball, or they are watching video games, playing video games and watching movies just like everyone else.
Yep.
You know, and sadly don't get out. So I also acknowledge like how fortunate I am that way to have spent time and got to grow up knowing that it's okay to be out there and what's available.
I think one of the in my travels, especially on the North Slope, and traveling the coast, you'll come across these old settlements with grave markers, and they're all the Spanish flu epidemic. It's all that just wiped out that. And that was, I always come back to that Raven's Gift when I'm in that situation. I'm like, wow, this is a very haunted, spiritual place that we seem to bury in our culture, Western culture. In fact, actually, the other day, I went to the Anchorage Cemetery. Have these, it's not a tour, but it's, they do a, sort of like a tour, but they have actors get up and act out people in the cemetery.
Oh, wow.
And it's pretty cool.
It brings that.
We just don't do that in our culture, right? And also you hear their story. And it's a really nice thing.
That would be a great thing for kids in school. I think we fail miserably, and here I am a teacher saying this, but I try not to do it in my classes. Like, we fail to teach our own history.
Yeah.
And it's so rich and powerful and scary and amazing. And I think that's part of my writing, is I just want to explore that and learn as much as I can and share those little mini discoveries.
And I think Alaska is so, we have this place called Alaska, and we have, and you've been affected, I've been affected, but it goes back, that sense of place, that sense of home is everywhere, and it goes back thousands and thousands and thousands of years for a lot of people.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's talk about Without a Paddle. Tell me about this. how did it come about? What is it?
Yeah, what is it is a really good question. Well, it's a collection of poems, a hodgepodge of my poetry. And my poetry is there's kind of nothing mystical or mysterious about it. It's pretty like it is what it is. It's not the stuff you read and go like, what's he thinking here? Like you know, I tell you what it, I think most of it sort of just kind of everyman kind of poetry.
Yeah.
It's not flowery. And yeah, that came about by a publisher contacting me, and her dad had been a PJ. Oh. And she was interested in what other kind of writing I had, and her mom had liked The Raven's Gift, and I was like, well, I got some poems, and so she's like, send them, and so and it all kind of transpired during the pandemic, and so yeah, it's a collection of my poetry, and it kind of covers everything from experiences where I, as a kid, from like without a paddle, being stuck in a boat and no gas and not having a paddle, to political things and kids and dogs and family and a lot of outdoor stuff too. It's me writing about experiences and things I think about.
Yeah.
And a lot of them kind of stem from April's National Poetry Month. And I'll usually like write a poem a day and just share them publicly.
Uh-huh.
And it's me kind of some of them stem from that project too over the years.
It's very accessible poetry. I was told recently, actually Mary Beth Holliman told me, oh, you have to read a poem twice or three times. And I think that's really true. Not a lot. Some of this I had to read a couple times, but a lot of this, like I said, I might read it and I'm like, oh, it really, you know, struck a chord and was very accessible.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Some of them are just silly, and then some of them are, yeah, maybe you read them 1.2 times, or maybe don't read it.
Right, right. We're going to take a break in a few minutes. Do you want to read the Without a Paddle and maybe explain that story a little bit?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
I can start with that one. Turn to the page of it.
While you're doing that, I think... yeah, I think I bought this. I mean, I know you. I'd like to write in, but being a paddler, I bought it because of the title. I'm like, oh, I gotta write that. I gotta buy that. So
Without a Paddle. So this is about an experience that I had when I was duck hunting with my buddy John Slim in Kasugaluk when I lived there as a kid. So I was in seventh or eighth grade, and. Yeah, I'll share just a little bit of this one. So, Without a Paddle. The motor sputtered a lifetime away from the village. John lifted the gas tank into the blue sky with one swift jerk. Empty. No current to carry us home. Across the shallow lakes, down the winding river, no wind to blow away the growing fog of buzzing vampires. The 14 feet of aluminum boat carried only the following: one 8th grade white boy in hip boots, one 10th grade Yupik bird hunting machine, two shotguns, several dead ducks, one empty red gas tank, one silver anchor with yellow rope. Missing. Gas or radio. So that's just part of it. And that commenced a long, long day of us being, completely stranded and knowing no one was coming to save us because no one was going to miss us because they knew we would be totally fine. And we were totally fine, but yeah, I tried everything. I tried oaring I put my shotgun into my hip boot and tried to paddle with that.
Yeah.
We took the cowling off the boat motor, tried to paddle with that. And ultimately, we came down to we would throw the anchor out and then pull the rope in, and that's how we moved.
That's a great story of kids learning, figuring things out, and resolving. We're going to take a short break. This is Outdoor Explorer. I have Don Ridden in the studio with me. You listen to Alaska Public Media.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm here with Don Reardon. Don, let's talk a little bit about writing and trauma. It seems that's a big part of your writing. Has it helped you? Have you helped yourself? You've helped other people? Talk about that.
Yeah, I think both. For me, I've lived an incredibly lucky life in terms of personal trauma. I've somehow avoided that, but not loss. Having grown up in Southwest Alaska, just the loss is immense. I can't even begin to capture that in terms of just tragedy and self-inflicted loss. And, you know, it's a weight you grow up bearing without knowing it, you know. And I think we find various ways to deal with it. And for me, writing has been a way to deal with that loss and making sense of it. And then I was realizing kind of as I was a teacher, I was realizing the power writing had with my students to help them deal with similar loss, because I would share with them how I was writing. And then and for trauma, I could see that affecting them too. I could see how it was helping people capture or take the power away from that trauma and control their own narrative. And so I think that also, in terms of the books I worked on, Never Quit and Warrior's Creed, I know it helped both of those men deal with the trauma they've endured.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think writing is just a really powerful way to deal with it. And the creativity of it and the exploring the story and taking the power back from it, so it doesn't control you, you control it.
Yeah, and I think that writing occupies a part of our brain which can get filled with other things, not necessarily healthy things, you know.
It leads to some catharsis, I think. Yeah. It surely does, and in some ways, too, it can be an escape.
Yeah.
And for me as a kid, it was an escape. I could, if whether it was escaping boredom, escaping, you know, if kids were up to no good, I'm working on something. I'm creative. I'm going somewhere else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think what's really interesting is, I just realized, this confluence of writing and outdoors. Outdoors, if you're bored, like a lot of us with a little bit of ADD or whatever, like, well, that's where we go, right? And then this sort of confluence of writing and then the outdoors. And some of our best writing is generated, you know, through outdoor. When you think about it, I just, for some reason, read War and Peace, and there's a lot of outdoors in that book. You know, it's not all great, but it's there. There's descriptions of Russia in that era. Were really fat, really amazing. We talked about the Warrior's Creed, but you also, and you have a bunch in here about suicide, which is a just rampant in rural Alaska.
Yeah, it's dealing with the loss too, or acknowledging that loss and honoring those people, you know, and figuring that out. Yeah. Yeah,
and to the outdoor thing, we have avalanches. So talk about the avalanche story a bit, and then we'll read that.
Oh, yeah. So one of my dear friends, who's a photographer and writer, Joe Yelverton, he survived an avalanche and lost a friend in it. And the writing process for him has been a catharsis for, you know, and a way towards healing. And so it's been fun to see him take that story and start to share it, become comfortable with it, and start to own it too. And I wrote a poem for him about that.
Yeah. And I think helped him with an article on Outside.
I coached him through some parts of it. Yeah, he definitely wrote. He did all the work. It was me. For mostly, it was me pushing him, like saying, "This is worth submitting. This is work that you need to share with the world."
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it didn't necessarily win an award, but Outside liked it.
It won their like inaugural Outside writing contest.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it was a big deal.
Yeah.
So I was super proud of him. Yeah. And I got to be like, told you so. Because I was like, it's a powerful story. And it's not just about, you know, everybody wants kind of the train wreck of telling, like, here's, you know, the horrors of what happened. But really, the real story is, how do you survive after something like that? And that's where the power is in telling that story.
Yeah, and there are a lot of people out there that could benefit from that. We hear about the fatalities because they make the news, or the dramatic rescues, but there are so much, you know, that people get caught and have near misses, and it really affects them. I have a friend going out right through some really, you know, tough time on something that never made the news, right?
I think Alaska has kind of some collective survivor's guilt, and I think maybe a lot of my writing probably originates out of that. And in a case like what Joe's telling with his avalanche story too, is it's the survivor's guilt. You're like, why am I alive? And and even just some of us who grew up in rural Alaska, you know, that's part of it too, where you lose so many people and you're like, how am I so lucky? And so for me, I think my writing is trying to make sense of that fortune, I guess, and also honoring the people that I've lost.
Yeah, and I think in the outdoors, that is, the longer you're at it, the longer, the more people you know. I lost my first dear friend, Tom Walter, in an avalanche on Mount Forkler in 1992, I think. Yeah. And so I was pretty, you know, I'd been up here for a little while, 6 years at that point, but that was the first person. And I remember Caden Plett out of Prince William Sound, off of Noel's course, and guy, Pete Heddle, the charter operator, picking me up and, you know, telling me, and he said, you know, people die in Alaska, not from old age, but from, you know, plane crashes, avalanches, drownings. He didn't have suicide, but he could have, you know. At that time, that was so true.
Yeah, falling through the ice
and
gun accidents. And I mean, it's just, in Alaska, it is its own sort of avalanche, you know.
That's right. It's a metaphor.
Yeah.
Well, why don't we read that and explain a little bit about this album? I think it was in Eagle Peak in the 80s. Is that right? So yeah. Eagle Peak's right out in the Chugach here in Anchorage.
Yeah. So this is me kind of imagining what it's like to be Joe in a way.
Yeah.
So this is before the avalanche. Before hell cracked loose far above and darkened our world, an apology, a revelation, the rising mountain between us fell away. Before the white wall of snow barreled towards us, we shared a moment that would keep me alive. Long after we were first swallowed, then beaten, buried. Long after I washed out, below, broken, battered, bruised. Long after you appeared, disappeared, again and again. Long after we fell, and the first night fell, haunting, and each thereafter. What came before the avalanche tore us apart, carries me forever over each mountain.
That's just fantastic. That's amazing.
So part of that story that to me is just really beautiful, and I mean, it's tragic, but the beautiful part of it is Joe and his climbing partner were sort of at odds a little bit, and they reconciled that on the mountain moments before that avalanche came and took him away. And so that was me kind of trying to make sense of that story and tell it in my way. His is a much longer, beautiful piece.
I highly
encourage people to check out.
Yeah, we'll have a link on that on our Outdoor Sport website for everybody. So there's some fun stuff in the book, too.
I tried.
you did. And I think I'm a birder, so let's somehow, I don't know, are you a birder? There's a lot about birds in here. How'd that come about?
Yeah, that's really funny. Am I a birder? I'm colorblind.
Okay.
So the bird books don't like help or make sense at all to me. And so that's always kind of funny. But I love Alaska's birds, and I'm always forever like trying to learn from them and learn about them and listen for them. So it is something. And I guess just because of how I'm like paying attention to the things around me, and the natural world around me, that I'm seeing those things, you know, seeing the birds.
And particularly the ravens, and that's obviously a cultural, a huge cultural piece.
Yeah, the ravens for sure.
And they're so ubiquitous. It's amazing where you go in Alaska, they tend to be there. And they are so smart and so, they're just amazingly smart birds. So you want to try to read, which one do we want to try to read?
Yeah, trying to find the new neighborhoods.
The new neighborhoods, it's page 92.
Page 92. Yeah. I'm glad you're better at this page thing than I am.
Yeah, your book's well marked.
It's too marked. So this is me sort of thinking about when neighbors move in and, you know, people are like, oh, they're bringing down the neighborhood or whatever, you know, and thinking about you know, gentrification and all those sort of things, and then how that work happens in the natural world. So this is called New Neighborhoods, and I'm breaking those up. Individual words there, new neighborhoods.
Yeah.
The valley clamor quieted when the Merlins swooped into the neighborhood, like flying bandits, boomerang-shaped raptors, zipping through the hemlock under stripes black against the azure sky. Even the largest of the songbirds, the ruling raven couple, sat stoic on a spruce top, their dark stare contempt as the invading immigrants laid claim to their old home, just a couple trees over from the new nest. There would be no friendly welcome, no apple pies or fresh cookies, just cold stillness. The chatter of the two falcons, an unwelcomed car alarm, in a place where they had never locked the doors. So yeah, those Merlins swoop in and just everything goes quiet.
Yeah. <You know? laughs> I like that. Never lock the doors. They left and there's another back. Yeah. Yeah. That's, I love that. I love that piece there because it describes in this world that we are a little oblivious to. And I don't think, like, if you live closer to the land, you're not, you know, you pay attention to those things.
Yeah. It is fun to be, I have some dear friends who are birders, and it's so fun to be out with them because you forget to listen, you know.
Yeah.
You're always looking around, and they're like, oh, you hear that? And like, no, I didn't, because I wasn't listening.
Right. Yeah, we're so focused on megafauna, and everybody wants to see the big five or the big eight or whatever it is, and then I always tell my students, oh, there's birds everywhere. You can you can be almost anywhere, and there's a bird, even if it's downtown Chicago or wherever, there's something to listen to. This is Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm Don Reardon in the neighborhood talking about his book, Without a Paddle. So Don, birds, we talked about birds. What else has really influenced you? Maybe family?
Yeah, of course, family. Family and community, you know, like the community that I grew up in just feels like family too. So that, and then I just feel like I have family all over Alaska, which is beautiful. And then my own family. I have two younger sisters and two incredible parents. My mom, I always joke, my mom's like the Indiana Jones. Like, she's a treasure hunter and educator and hunter. And
What did your parents do?
My mom was a teacher, and my dad was in law enforcement.
Oh, wow.
So the joke was the ones my mom screwed up with, my dad would help later.
Yeah.
And then have my own kids, younger kids. They're just starting school today. So, yeah, it was pretty exciting. And to get them out the door. And then having kids has brought different perspective to the outdoors for me too, which has been really neat to share that with them and realize like that's what a great place we would grow up in and live in to have your kids kind of learn about all that's here.
Yeah. And if you traveled, I know there's we'll get to a poem about when your kids point something out, but you also write about Florida and other travel. So was that partly kid related, I assume?
Yeah, we travel a lot. The Florida stuff that's in the book, I didn't have kids then, and we were traveling with my wife's family and when their kids were little. And so it was me. Yeah, I think sometimes my writing is me making sense of the other world, the outside world.
Yeah.
Not outside outdoors, but like outside of Alaska. And yeah, Florida was an eye-opener to me. Yeah, Disneyland was, whoa. It was Disney World, I guess. Like,
how did you sort of make sense of that?
Oh, man. I guess it's kind of just constantly thinking about how we live here and kind of live a simpler, easier life in so many ways, and not trying to keep up with the Joneses, and and then just that world, the kind of cookie cutter world, or there's a community down there, I can't remember what the name of it, Celebration or something, where the housing looks like it's right out of like the 50s.
Oh,
like white picket fences, and yeah, it's just surreal, right? Yeah. And so you know, growing up in a village and then going to see something like that, you're like, whoa.
Well, and the whole sort of artificialness of what it puts at Disney World or Disneyland.
Yeah.
Family, what do you learn from your kids?
Oh, man. I think the first thing that was one of the really interesting experiences I had was, I've had a couple, like, you know, like all of us that spend time outside, life and death experiences. And before kids, all you're concerned about is yourself, you know, and you're like, oh, I'm going to die. And like, okay, you know, I have to figure this out. And then when you have a kid and that's happening, not that the kid's with you, but they're back home and you're like, I'm going to leave my kid without a parent. You know, it's the first time that happened to me, I was in tears. Like I'd never been like trying to survive and like in tears. know? that was new to me. Because
what was that experience? If you want to share.
Oh, it's too embarrassing.
That's all right.
No, it was my first and last pack rafting experience.
Oh boy.
Yeah. Just imagine an idiot like pack rafting down a glacier creek. We won't say which one. Like with a bike helmet and some, you know, shorts on. Yeah.
Not prepared. Gotcha.
Yeah. In a boat that's running out of air.
Oh boy.
Yeah. It was terrifying and horrible. And yeah, I survived. But I think go back to your question, like learning about that, like learning the value of I grew up, you know, like always being prepared and be ready for anything, and then to have to kind of to know how to teach your kid that and teach them respect for the land. In so many ways, respect for what it can do to you, but also what it can give you, and what it can teach you. And so, yeah, I think for me, that's been the learning experience.
And you write about what one of your kids' daughters at that?
Pointed
something out to you. You want to share that?
Yeah. So I think, you know, I'm always trying to teach my kids to be good human beings and also pay attention to what's around them and be present, and then maybe sometimes realizing I'm not doing that. So this is a poem about that exact thing. It's called Listen and Learn. I swung her around to my back, clasped my hands together beneath her little bottom, squatted, grabbed the dog leash, turned toward home. Her little cartoon chatter skipped from colors and mountains. I like to ride piggyback and trees, rocks, funny puppy, big truck, listen to the water, where's mama? And next time I'll travel with her on an airplane. Somewhere between it all, she said, I see a big fat moose. My mind scrolled back through her rambling and struck on big, fat. I didn't like her saying that. I wondered where she heard such an insensitive phrase. I was ready for the talk with her brother. Where did you hear that? I asked. Right there. Her arm shot out, a pointing finger. Then, movement in the alders, half again the length of the dog leash away, uncomfortably close, a big, fat moose. So yeah, that was the experience of the big fat moose, and oh man, it was too close, and I wasn't paying attention.
yeah, and they were, and she was.
Yeah, she was. She totally was. Yeah.
Huh. So other themes you have in this, but there's just so many. I tried to categorize, and there's a lot of sort of political talk about global warming and climate change, and that is obviously important to you.
Yeah, and you know, I think hopefully in Alaska we move past that being political too. I think because we've seen it, we've seen the change, and again, I keep referring to the stuff I grew up with, but as long as I can remember, the elders were saying, things are changing, and because they were at the ground level and they were seeing those changes happening on the tundra to the animals. And so, yeah, it's just something I think for me, again, it's probably a little bit of using writing to address that loss and the change there. So there's that. And then there's just some political fun. I like to poke fun at hypocrisy when I see it, or idiocracy when I see it too.
I'm going to can I read one?
Yes,
it's very
please.
Short. It's right next to the last one you read. It's called Arctic Warming. It's a little play on words. And it goes, melting permafrost, sinkholes open to reveal the past is the future. A comment on that?
Oh, man.
There's a lot there.
Yeah, there's a lot there. So I think I was trying for just that idea of, As the things are thawing, it's opening up these holes that are pointing to what's to come.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and I also took that as saying, well, there's also we're discovering things, whether it's gravesites being exposed, and you know, there's literally things that are being, the past is being revealed in some ways.
The past is being revealed, and we're trying to bring it back too, you know, like whether we're going to clone a mammoth or they just brought that 40,000-year-old worm back to life or something.
Oh, I hadn't heard about that.
Yeah, scary stuff.
Right, yeah. Also, I think there's a sort of unifying theme a little bit. You talk about political differences and trying to... maybe that we're not all that different.
Yeah, that's definitely part of it. I think I don't like conflict. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you have villages up north where the people can't be in conflict or the whales are going to know that, right?
Yeah.
And then you're not going to have food. And, I mean, that's just on a real basic level that communities need to get along if we're going to succeed and survive. And so I think, I'm really troubled by conflict, and I want everybody to get along and put those differences aside when we can.
Yeah. And writing and poetry can do that.
I hope so. Yeah, I hope so.
So speaking of whales, there's one on bowheads, and if we have can see that one up, I think that's a fascinating 200 years, I think.
Yeah, 200 years. Of course, I need that page number again. Where am I at on that?
117.
Okay. People will know which page to turn to. So, again, this is learning from the land and learning from what people already know. And so this is me kind of making sense of something I find is, like, really magical. It's called 200 Years. I have swam beneath the ice for 200 winters. Watched 200 summer suns shine upon this turbulent sea, saw your kin upon the shore, stepping gently, leaving only footprints first, then wooden paddle strokes, soon rumbles and streaks in the sky. I have seen your rise, rapid as the moonlight spread across a tundra plain, and now watch while the moonset makes ready, remembering how 200 years you watched for my spout. Saw hope in the mist, made my grandmother into corsets, carved my mother for a mangled meal for the bottom crawlers with war weapons, steel whales with your men sealed, screaming inside. Some of your kind believe we wield the ability to hear those thoughts in your head, your actions, are already gale force. Only if you listened long enough at the ocean's edge, everything would crystallize clear, and 200 years you would bear witness from sea. So that's this idea of the whales, the bowhead whales, and the, you know, like one of our most ancient creatures, and what they would know about us and what they've seen in Alaska from the, you know, our first peoples to our first, you know, wars.
Yeah.
The last shots of the Civil War and fired in Alaska, and then, you know, World War II and men dying in submarines off the Aleutian Trenches. And yeah.
That's something that is almost hard to imagine.
It's
like a yeah. very, very smart, very sentient creature.
Yeah.
That's seen and probably remembering that stuff.
Yeah. You know? Or, and being taught by elders who've, you know, remembered right. the really rich times. And yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And that sort of what's next for you? Okay, right, well, kind of close to the end here, so that, yeah. that sort of leads to what's next.
That's great. That poem essentially sort of leads into the novel that I just wrote. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I'll have a publisher for it or what's going to happen with it, but it's called Heart of a Whale,
mm-hmm.
and it's a bowhead whale telling his story.
Oh, cool!
And it's yeah, I had a lot of fun writing it, and. I enjoy it. I might just have to just give it away if I don't have a publisher, because I don't want it to languish. I yeah. want it. It's a story that I think we can learn from. I learned writing it. I learned a ton, and I enjoyed that. So hopefully somebody will get to read that someday.
There's so much we haven't talked about. Dogs. There's a lot about dogs in here. I assume that's sort of a village thing for you.
I just grew up with dogs. Yeah. I love dogs.
Yeah, so there's a lot of great stuff about dogs. There's a lot of humor. There's some great play on words with the social media thing. And I love that. Bikes. There's bikes in here also. Baseball. The list goes on and on.
Yeah, it's really scattered. I think like most people, when they release a book of poetry, it's very like focused and theme based. And this is just me. It's
yeah.
just, this is like, hey, here's my life. Maybe it's my biography in poem form or something.
The one I wanted to end up with, because I think it really stretches, it's called Listen on page 162.
Thanks. Yeah, this is probably the theme of the book, I guess, in yeah. various ways. Listen. Listen. You can hear your heart. Listen. Animals will speak. Listen. Walls are no obstacle. Listen. Water whispers become roars. Listen. Trails call to you. Listen. Ancient spirits sing. Listen again to your heart.
Love it. That's really
thanks, Paul. Thank you.
I think listening and observing is maybe the heart of the poetry.
yeah. And I think just listening to ourselves, you know, like try to find a space where it's so quiet you can hear your heartbeat. I think that's an important thing to learn, especially in today's day and age. We don't do that enough.
Yeah, and to each other.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for joining me today, Don.
Oh man, thank you so much. This has been great fun.
My guest today has been Don Reardon. We'll have a link to his website on the Outdoor Explorer webpage. Big thanks to our producer, Eric Bork. This is your host, Paul Torduck. And from all the hosts at Outdoor Explorer, thanks for listening. And I'll say there's nothing like a good book and a tent on a rainy day. And we'll see you outdoors.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.